It's unfortunate because Siam no longer exists. But
Siam, what a Siam!
But the, so you can actually make porn there. You can make porn where. Siam
well, you. Was. I guess you could do it with cats.
Siamese,
because there are Siamese cats. Yeah, you ain't got a Siamese cat.
Meow.
All right, Alice is cute though.
So we can start whenever we want.
I thought.
Should we?
Yeah.
Hey.
Hey.
All right, in 5, 4, 3, 2, act natural.
Hey, what's going on, everybody? It's me, Professor Robot.
And it's me, Dr. Octave.
And welcome to episode 3 of Cartoon Violence Has a Podcast.
Yes.
Oh, and it's such a wonderful, glorious episode because today we have extra super duper special guests joining us in Happy Hollow.
Is that what we're christening this place, Happy Hollow? Now?
No, sure.
Was it right, not we've renamed this Happy Hollow. I don't know if you guys got the memo.
Fantastic.
Oh, right. Perfect.
You want to introduce yourselves?
My name's Corbett.
And my name's Dan.
And we are Bobby Joe Ebola and the Children McNuggets.
And you're officially sponsored by the McNugget Corporation?
They've never come after us.
Yeah, they've never tried to stop us. That's as close as we care about an endorsement.
Okay.
Ebola
implicit endorsement.
Yeah.
Not being sued, that's all you need.
Yeah, pretty much.
Absence of lawsuit equals, you know, endorsement.
There are those drunken days like when I used to do the walk of shame and I'd be hungover and I'd walk to McDonald's and I'd be sitting there and eating some of their food. And I kept thinking to myself like some fan of my band or a punk kid would walk by and be like, "Say it ain't so, Bobby Joe," you know, and like flip out that somehow I was eating McDonald's or he saw me eating McDonald's. But that never happened because we're not that popular.
Okay. So just popular enough to not have people give you
popular enough to. Not popular enough that you can not only eat McDonald's, but not get sued by them.
Yeah.
So you're just under, you're at that perfect level.
TMZ isn't going to be like, you know, Corbett Redford ate a McDonald's.
We can walk into a McDonald's and none of the employees know who we are. They haven't been warned about us. They'll still serve us.
Now, what if you walk into a McDonald's you used to work at? Would they know you then?
Well, I never worked at McDonald's, but I did work at Jack in the Box for 2.5 years.
Do you have any secrets about their tacos you'd like to share?
You know, after about 94, there was a big E. coli outbreak at a couple of Jack in the Box places, and
I remember that.
I believe it had something to do with
fajitas, right?
With some non-fresh food. So that what they did was they had all these food timers. So when the Jack in the Box tacos come out, they would put them on these little kind of file cabinet looking things with timers for 15 minutes. And after 15 minutes, you're supposed to just throw the tacos away. Well, of course, the manager, being the thrifty fellow that he was, would just reset the timer every 15 minutes.
Oh,
and so it would go on for hours and hours. And I'm assuming that that's how it is at most Jack in the Boxes.
Business model.
Yeah,
just reset it.
Pretty much. I had to end up calling the health department. We left on tour, and I finally quit after almost 3 years there working the night shift. And I was the only native English speaker that worked at Jack in the Box. And so all the other employees took me aside separately. And would you please call the health department? Because we had a backup of gray water on the kitchen floor. So everyone's splashing around basically in liquid poop. And it was disgusting. Like, even if we weren't serving food, like if it was just a thing you had to walk through, it would be gross, but we're in it for like 8 hours and our black pants are getting all stained and you know how water kind of soaks up the, anyhow,
capillary action.
Yeah, exactly. So, because the other employees were all from different countries, they were worried that that someone would recognize their accents and that they would be deported. So they asked me, since I had nothing to lose, to call the health department So I finally did, and they had to be shut down for 3 days, which for a 24-hour operation, that's a lot of Jumbo Jacks.
Now, why hasn't that made it into a song yet?
It has.
Or did it?
Well, I mean, actually, you used to see, what, E-40 in the drive-thru? Too short?
I got super bored. Actually, a lot of the early Bobby Joe songs were written on receipt paper at Jack in the Box. Because at 3 a.m, you know, maybe there's like an hour and a half, 2 hours where no one shows up. If I wasn't writing songs, I would put 3 chairs together and lay down. And when someone drove over the little sensor thing, the headset would go off and wake me up.
I would write lyrics on envelopes at the pizza parlor that I worked at, Round Table Pizza. Mm-hmm. One day we converged, and I was also working at a Starbucks at the time. This is like 20 years ago, something like that.
We're old.
I was working at a Starbucks, and you were working at a theater, and you came home, and you had just somebody had vomited in the bathroom, and you went to your boss, and you said, "Hey, do you have a mop?" And you said,
"Oh, right, yeah. Right, that's right, because it was they wanted me to clean the bathroom because it was like flooded. The toilet was blocked up with
and they gave you dinner napkins.
Right. They're like, "We don't want you to get the." I'm like, "Okay, where's the mop? Sure, I'll clean it up." And they're like, "Well, that's the thing. We just got this mop.
You came back soaked in poo.
We don't want to get it dirty."
I had just left my shift at Starbucks, and somebody, some dude, had just shot his seed all over the mirror in the bathroom, and all of the women on the shift were freaking out. And so I was forced to go in and clean it up. So I remember Dan converged from having to clean up vomit with dinner or poop with dinner napkins, and I converged from having to clean up splooge with dinner napkins. And we sat on a couch, and we both wrote you wrote the beginning of the song. I wrote the rest of the song,
mm-hmm.
called "I've Got a Bomb," but we actually themed it around the other mutual job that both of us shared.
Yeah.
And so when the people tried to fire us for hearing that song, we were like, no, you don't understand. It's not really about that job.
It's a composite of all the shitty jobs.
And it didn't work. They fired us. So.
I do love that song. My friend and I used to use that song as our way of complaining about the jobs that we had when we were teenagers. Which brings us back to the mid-90s, doesn't it?
Cast your mind all the way back to the mid-90s.
Because there was like, you know, there's China, chapters.
The Chinese chicken.
There's the Bare Naked Ladies era, Bobby, Joey Bull, and the Children McNuggets. And then there's the 21st century.
Some would say the Bare Naked Ladies period never ended.
It ended when that guy got caught with all those guns and coke in his trunk from the Bare Naked Ladies. That's what I think.
Which I had nothing to do with, by the way.
Yeah. You had nothing to do with Bare Naked Ladies?
No.
So
sadly.
So I remember the first time I ever heard Bobby Joe Ebola, I was at a LAN party at my friend Brad's house. The spirit of Christmas had just hit the early internet scene, and everybody was watching the South Park pilot before the show was ever even on the air. And Brad happened to be the drummer. Second drummer, I believe, for the Hope Bombs, who were a Spam Records band.
Brad Smith.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Brad Smith.
Yeah.
And he said, "You would love these guys." And he played me "I Wish I Was Special." And I fell in love.
Wow.
I think the first time I ever heard you guys, it was in his car. Because he had the CD, and I don't know. I think it was like, it was interesting because we were like a couple nerdy kids who were also into music, but like there was, you know, beyond like stuff like Weird Al, like, you know, nowadays, you know, there's, you can talk about like Tenacious D, or you could talk about Flight of the Conchords, or you could talk about like all these other like random like sort of comedy bands, but there wasn't really a lot of stuff like going on at the time. So it was like, it was eye opening.
It was hard for us at that time, I think, because we wanted to get laid. And if you were in a comedy band, everyone's like, "Oh, you know.
We imagined that getting laid was a wonderful thing, and so we strove for it with everything we had, and rather than say, oh yeah, we're a funny comedy band, check us out, we sort of, I think we were a little embarrassed about what we were, and so we're like, no, we're
scary.
We're doing something different. It's funny. Artful, it's funny, weird. But it's fuck you. You know.
I mean, for me, the turning point was us being on that Long Beach radio station with the Chris Waffle show.
Chris Waffle,
which was a novelty based kind of, and we love the doctor, Dr. Nemento. I communicate with him here and there. Very good, very supportive of us over the years. But a lot of his legions are, 40-year-old virgins in Hawaiian shirts with kazoos. And they, so this one guy, Chris Waffle, he had the show, and he was like, wacky, wacky, wacky. And we had been on tour, and we were hungover, and we were unshaven, and we were stinky, and we were playing rock clubs, and...
He was like John Candy's character in Little Shop of Horrors.
He was like that. We showed up at his radio show, and we were just surly. And I remember, like, John, who was our old backup singer, he was, like, siphoning whiskey and eating Flaming Hot Cheetos at the same time, and we were just like, and he's like, wacky, wacky, and we're like, and to me, that was a point where we were like, okay, we're going to be a rock and roll band. We're not going to be this comedy shit or something. But, you know, I mean, you get older, and you're like, yeah, we're totally a comedy band, and we're a rock and roll band, you don't have to put yourself in a box.
You don't feel so pigeonholed anymore.
We love that the doctor embraced us back then. I mean, that was a huge honor, you know? Of course, yeah, we still wanted to get laid.
I mean, it also took us a long time, like the process of going through music and following our hopes and dreams and yada, yada, all that crap, taught us a lot about ourselves and the world around us. We learned that it was okay to like ourselves, even if we were the only ones.
So did you guys ever get laid? And was it the music, or was it like learning to be yourselves?
That's a good question.
You can go first.
Now, okay, I did get laid because I was in a band before.
You have a kid, so you can prove it.
I can prove it, yes.
You have evidence.
All my evidence is circumstantial.
You know, I think that the whole band thing led to actually like having a social compartment to kind of like meander in, you know.
Got me out of the house.
I think I wound up finally getting acceptance or being comfortable around girls or whatever because the band helped me. The band helped me figure out who I was, I think, in a lot of ways.
Gave me a reason to go outside and like go have an... I can't just go to parties and like, oh, hey, how's it going? Let's party. Like, but if I'm helping set up the party or if I'm playing the show, if I have some kind of purpose, then I'm much more at ease. And so like setting up shows and playing shows and going on tour and like having a reason to be out and contributing something to whatever social scene, made it a lot easier to build social skills, because otherwise I don't know what sort of nerd I would be.
When you're building your own thing, it's nobody can tell you that you don't belong.
Yeah, no, it's true. I definitely can relate to that. Like, I like, you know, socializing here and there, but I always feel better about going to a party or something if I'm going to play, because I feel like it's more like being like, you know, this is actually who I am. This is what I actually do. Like, you know, it's the most honest that I can be with people in a lot of ways.
People always say, Dan and Corbett, you guys are funny, and the way that you communicate is like, oh, you respond to each other and this kind of stuff. And it's who we are. Like, you know,
there's that whole thing in rock and roll where it's like, your on stage persona is sometimes like an amplified version of part of yourself. Like, you know, Jim Morrison from The Doors, like the Lizard King, like that was part of his personality.
But it got blown up
on the stage. And then some people start to inhabit that all the time off stage. I think that one thing that maybe sets Bobby Joe Ebola apart from other bands is that that's us on stage. Like, it's not like really a character that we're playing. It's just like we're going up on stage and pouring our hearts out, or whatever it happens to be.
We have grown and changed, though, and that gets complicated for people.
Yes.
Yeah. Do they expect like more songs about shit eating?
Oh yes.
Every album. Like,
I mean, the main, we go to different towns, and I won't call any of them out, but it'll be like a lot of people who like ICP also like Bobby Joe Ebola. And do we consider ourselves not trashy, semi-intellectual? Yeah, I guess. You know, is it kind of strange to when somebody's like, "Hey, play that song about the retards. Play that song about the shit eating and all that stuff." You know, and like it's like we'll sometimes unveil those songs.
Sometimes there's booze involved.
Sometimes there's booze involved. I think that we have to acknowledge that sometimes. Something that particularly stands up in my mind is we did a call out and we did on Kearney, and you knew more of the lyrics than we did a couple years back or something. But we try to like not bury our. That's the big thing, is that people talk about the Beastie Boys. They were so irreverent and sexist and misogynist and horrible and all this kind of stuff. And then they renounced everything that they did. The thing is that we kind of, with this book that we recently did, the Bobby Joe Ebola songbook, we wanted to present our entire discography. And we did. And Dan came up with a great thing for the forward. You can't bury your past you can't learn from your past if you bury your mistakes. And now, what's writing a song about handicapped people and calling them retarded a mistake? No, because I can speak very openly about how that song was very cathartic for me. You know,
a lot of our early songs, you know, they were experiments in communication. Like we were awkward, nerdy teenagers that didn't know how to talk to girls, didn't know how to talk to colleges or adults, or like really didn't know how to make our way in the world, and communicating through songs and jokes and whatever was our way of kind of working through really serious stuff. So like On Kearney is a great example of things that we are just blown away by. Like, it's a true story, right? There was a serial killer, or the two serial killers
in our backyard,
in El Sobrante, who were killing hookers and burying them in their backyards. And we're like, oh my God, those were my buddies' next door neighbors. Like, I used to walk past them every day. Like, whoa.
Those hookers were buried out where we walk around and take mushrooms.
Right. Yeah. And so we wrote a song that, you know, we tried to sort of soften the blow a little bit. And not all of our songs came out the way that we would write them today, for sure. Because, you know, it's been a lifetime.
Yeah,
but like I'm literally twice the man that I was when that song was written.
Yeah, but you know, that's gonna be something that everybody as a musician faces. You know, there's obviously stuff that I've wrote that I would be like, oh my God, like I can't believe like this is what I was thinking at the time. It's like going back and looking at your old live journal posts.
Oh God, please no.
Right, exactly. And these are things that, like, just because we continued to play the music, like a lot of those songs stayed in circulation for quite a long time, even after we got out of the suburbs, and we just through playing and putting on shows and meeting people, we learned like, oh wait, maybe there's other ways of communicating. Maybe there's actually some of the things we're saying are actually hurting people, like, or are part of larger systems that do hurt people. And so, like, we've definitely tried to be aware of humor. We never want to punch down. Like, it's not cool, really, to make fun of people that are like already getting kicked.
Even in "I Wish I Was Special," the retard, if you in quotes there, comes up, you know, and that I mean, I know it sounds very strange, but I felt very pretty much disabled as a kid. You know, there's a lot of things wrong with me and that I had to really, really combat about.
Some things never change.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, no, it's true. And I've just had to work really hard at not feeling feeble or feeling, and so that in that song, I mean, I was the retard. I was the, when I would sing it, I would feel that. Of course, there was also like the venom, the strange, weird, uncomfortable venom that I let loose in the middle of it, yelling about Corky from Life Goes On and about how no one will ever, yeah, no one will ever love you because you're a potato head and that kind of stuff. I don't know if there's any justification for that, but.
Well, I do remember that there came a time when we lived at this house together in Pinole, like that we had to make a really serious decision as a band and as a household, because there was a you know, the guy who played Corky on Life Goes On, he was also in a made for TV movie called Touched by an Angel, where he played an angel with Down syndrome.
That same night that was set to air.
Yeah. The same day that was playing, they were also airing on a different channel, the Dukes of Hazzard reunion show.
They were going to fire the flaming crossbow.
We had to think long and hard about this, but it turned out that, James, our housemate, said, you know, if we can watch the Dukes of Hazzard thing, I will slam two tall boys of Budweiser. And we're like, all right, it's on.
Yeah, so we didn't watch.
Corky's going to have to wait another day.
Oh, poor Corky. So I've got a button over here that says you don't have to die alone on it. And it's got a plane flying into the Twin Towers. Where does that sit in your past possibly being learning opportunities?
That button was made by a friend of ours named Beckett. And he's a button maker in Cleveland. Also, he was in Beckett and Friends, an old Spam Records recording artist. And he knew we were about to go to New York, and he made these buttons.
We got snowed in at his house for 3 days, and he's all like, "Well, I got some booze, and I got a button maker."
And he says, "If you don't take these with you, you guys are chumps." And we went into New York.
We ain't chumps.
With the buttons, and a lot of New Yorkers bought them and laughed and put them on and said, you know, if a cop sees me, I'm dead. You know, I can't wear this. You know, I think that whole you don't have to die alone sentiment and the whole tying it with 9/11 and everything. I don't have any. I would have less regrets about pairing those ideas together than I would about anything else we've done. I mean,
yeah, I mean, you know, of course, tragedy, people dying, all that stuff. But you know, the way that the world goes, and one of the things that has formulated a philosophy of Bobby Joe, if there is one, is that the world is so wretched and messed up that, you pretty much either laugh or scream. And, you know, in this band, we get to do both.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just, you know, I bring it up because there was that German Wings plane crash.
Oh, sure.
Weeks ago. And honestly, the first thing that came into my head was that song, You Don't Have to Die Alone.
Sure, yeah.
And just, you know, whether it's used as a, you know, a route to use black humor to deal with tough situations.
Sure. Or, and,
you know,
and it's not us saying like, listen, everyone, we really want you to go out there and kill yourself and take as many people out as possible. That's not, just to be clear, that's, we are not, we are not advocating mass murder suicide. We also don't want to tell anyone what to do. But there are times when it feels like that's the only way out, that like suicide isn't extreme enough. You know, you feel so shitty that you don't want to just take yourself out, but you want to inflict your pain on everyone. And that's more or less what that song's
only
about.
You, there, you could have been there when those Columbine boys. did their thing, dog.
If I had been about 4 years younger, I would have been one of those Columbine. But if my parents had owned guns, I almost certainly would have brought one to school.
Mm.
But that's pretty much the main difference is that, A, I wasn't on meds because those hadn't come into vogue yet. I was a little too old for that. And B, my parents didn't have guns.
I on that for a minute. Some things never change.
So when are you buying that gun?
I had a gun once, but I gave it away.
To a needy preschool?
My ex, actually.
All right, so there's the bare naked ladies period that we've kind of been going over, and then, like, then what happens? Like, what happens after the bare naked ladies are no longer in vogue?
When do you think the bare naked ladies era of our career ended?
Well, okay, so I know this much. I don't know how we're chronologically.
Tell me the story of Bobby Joe.
Okay, so at One with the Dumb comes out, and the songs on there are pretty offensive, but there's also some neutral stuff. There's some stuff about love songs, just stuff about college.
Yeah.
Some weird shit.
And then there's a split with your mother.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There was the Spam Records comp that had the Hermie Halpert and She Ain't No Crip.
Yes.
Was the
Two Cats Running EP, which is before all that.
Before all that.
And then there's Carmelita Sings.
Right. And that came out, what, 2099?
2000.
Okay. Because I remember I moved up to Seattle in 2000, and I didn't hear when it came out. But that summer, I was like browsing the internet, and people were talking about this new Bobby Joe Ebola album like it was already a thing. And I was like, why didn't I know? Oh, because I moved out of the Bay Area. That's why. But Carmelita Sings, still some pretty offensive stuff on there. You know, Child Killer. Liver Lover is fun to me, not offensive. You know, there's nothing.
I lived it, though.
Yeah. You actually fucked a liver?
No, my roommate did.
Oh, okay.
And Dan wrote a song about it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, he told me the story. He
like plastic bag and everything.
Yeah, he told me all about it and
so maybe the bare naked lady stuff is like from 2010 till now. Is that no?
I don't know. It wasn't my analogy.
No, I'm just guessing.
But I do remember seeing the bare naked ladies in Seattle in 2000. So maybe that's when the period ended. After Carmelita Sings would be the end of the bare naked ladies period.
Okay. All right. I think I can. Well, it's also like Carmelita Sings was the first recording that we did not stoned.
Uh huh.
So that might have been a big difference because
Carmelita Sings.
Yeah. I wasn't high.
I swear to God, we were all high.
I learned my mistake from
that one with the dumb.
Yeah, One with the Dumb.
I was high.
Because the guy that we recorded our first EP, the Two Cats Running EP, and
Feed Us Weed.
And at One with the Dumb, he had a big bowl of weed in the studio. And he's like, oh yeah, it comes with the price of the studio, which was fucking brilliant. Because
you're just gonna sit there and get super high.
We spent so much time just trying to get this dog to bark right for to get it the right growl or to get the right kind of reverb for the phone call scene.
We can't fix this in post. We've got to do it live.
We've got to do it. Everything was so slow, and we just it was fun, but as far as finished product, like. I was much happier with the way Carmelita Sings came out.
Me too. I mean, a lot of people say Carmelita Sings is our best record. I mean,
it's like three records. There's enough on there for at least one good record.
Yeah, I was actually just listening to it on the way over and was surprised at how long it lasted.
It's a long record.
We never hear that. Yeah.
I mean, one of the things was that we just didn't record for a long time. And then it was like, that was the trajectory.
Yeah, like 2 years.
Was that, no, 97 was at One with the Dumb.
Right, and then we recorded in the summer of 99.
For the split?
For Carmelita.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, I guess. So all that came in 2 years.
Yeah.
And then there was what, a 10-year hiatus?
Pretty much.
Like eight, yeah.
8 years, yeah. Well, the weird thing about the hiatus was, I think, I say this, I had a lot of demons catching up to me from when I was young. And the weird thing about the whole thing was that Dan and I didn't have like a bitter, it wasn't a bitter breakup. Like it wasn't, we would still be roommates over the course of those 8 years.
We would occasionally be homeless when the other had a, when the other person had a house.
Yeah. And so we, it was like, and so people were always like, why are you not playing music together? And some people say that it was that we finally got this measure of acceptance that we didn't know how to deal with. You know, our last show at Gilman in 2000 was sold out, you know. And for me, it was just all, I think I was just ground down. And I don't know what it was, but one day you were booking the tour. We were set to play with, like, what, MDC or something? Mm-hmm. ABC, no, Rio.
The tour, we had some really good shows. Like, we were going to do this big U.S. tour, and we had some really good shows lined up, but overall the tour was just,
there's holes all through it.
It was going to be a huge clusterfuck.
I had demons catching up with me. I just went through a bad breakup, and things just were too. And I remember just walking into the living room, and we just knew, we didn't say anything.
Well, yeah, we just kinda knew. You have to understand that, like, when we originally started the band, we said we'll do this as long as it's fun. And, you know, at that point, you know, it wasn't just the band. It was, we were also running a record label. We were doing festivals, and really, like, all that energy that a lot of people will just put into their band, we were splitting three ways.
So when we came back, we put it all into our band, pretty much, and only our band.
Yeah, we weren't putting out a million records for other people. We weren't putting on a bunch of free shows, which it was all lots and lots of fun. Like, it was super, super valuable in terms of just, you know, life experiences.
It's a pain in the butt.
Yeah. Left us totally broke and bitter and withered.
That's really what was going on. Yeah, I mean, it was every year after we broke up. In fact, like, a month after we broke up, Gilman was like, hey, we're doing a benefit for a sound system. Would you do a quick reunion for us? And then our friends whose mom just died, and they had these kids that needed money, they were like, hey, we saw you did that. Will you do this show? So, like, a month after we broke up, we played two shows.
Yeah.
And then every year it would be like, hey, somebody's having this birthday party, or we need this benefit. So we would play just about once a year, I think, during that hiatus. We didn't write. We didn't record. We didn't do anything. And then 2000, a series of events happened, and we wound up starting up again.
So you guys are just like, let's do this.
Well, that was that was interesting. So
part of what was going on was that years ago we did we wrote a rock opera about a sausage,
yeah,
right, Mr. Sausage Brand Microwave Rock Opera, and we had been given an offer of, like, if you could write a script for a pilot, you know, might be able to get it on, you know, as a cartoon, like, we could probably do it. So we thought, well, you know, why the hell not?
Like, the script is sitting there.
So
now Seth Rogen has a musical coming out with a sausage.
Right. So anyhow, we got together, and it had been years, and we started working on this pilot, but in order to do so, we had to kind of relearn the songs from the rock opera. So I went over to his house, brought my guitar, and we're kind of like going through the songs, which are the whole story. We had to write stuff in between the songs.
The Mystic Knights of the Cobra got a hold of us.
Right. And I had written a few songs in the intervening years. I'm like, hey, check this out, blah, 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 blah. And we really had no expectations of reforming the band, but our friends from Crockett, Mystic Knights of the Cobra, had just put out a record, and they said, hey, would you guys do a reunion show and, you know, play our CD release party?
So while we're working on this opera, making it into a script, and then our old friends ask us to play, it was like, we played, and I think this is the crazy part. I mean, I think we both left that show with like a grand in our pocket.
Something like that. And keep in mind, like,
we did it for the money, kids.
I went to school and got out of college finally in spring of 2009. Like, I finally got my degree then, although I'd been out of school for a year. Just long story. But right in time for the economy to hit the dumper. And so trying to find a job with an anthropology degree, it's laughable. Laughable. So I was literally eating like a potato a day and like borrowing money to make rent and bills and in pretty, pretty desperate straits. So when that show happened, I'm like, whoa, I can like pay rent. That's new. I think, didn't I sell you my amp at one point? Nice. Yeah.
I still use that amp all the time.
I'm glad you got it working.
Yeah.
Thank you. I mean,
it was tricky, but I figured it out.
Over the course of the next 5 years after that, we just decided like, hey, let's try this again. So slowly, I think we played a show. Our next show was like with Classics of Love with Eric Finale.
Down mm-hmm. there, yeah, in San Jose.
Oh,
San
we know Jose. We know Eric Finale.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry.
No, everybody's sorry. It's okay.
Yeah.
Moving on. We love you, Eric.
We did that, and then we started playing more and more shows, and then before you knew it, it was like 5 years fast forward, self-booked over 500 shows nationally and internationally, did two Kickstarter campaigns, three, one for a video, one for a van, and one for something else. I can't remember what it was. No, maybe.
Was it Life is Excellent?
No, the video. Yeah.
Yeah.
But basically, mostly we did two LPs, seven seven-inch singles, 14 music videos, one that we crowdsourced. The rest were all independent. We funded them. And then these two books. One of them was a read-along storybook with a CD in it, and the next one was a songbook. And it was just, we just didn't stop. It was just constantly, I mean, and it's scary, and it's harrowing, and it's...
And a little bit addictive.
And it's addictive, and you, and things are like, God, you know, how much can we keep this momentum up? This is crazy. More and more people are excited about the new stuff that we're doing, and oh, that video was great, and this, I love this,
That's awesome that you guys like hit the ground running, because I think a lot of bands, especially bands that just kind of like achieved a certain level of fame, like, and then called it a day, like it would be tough for them to like pick up that pace like again right away after that long.
Dan always says, there's one thing, if it's one thing, we're not short on ideas. We may be short on money, but we're not short on ideas. So I think that our disconnect is that we don't think about the fact that we don't have money. And it's like the creature comforts kind of go over to the side, and it's like, well, we know that we feel that this is what we do best, and this is what we want to do all the time. And
money's nice, but
suddenly, I mean, it was like, where do we get these books out? And we're supposed to go on a tour with these books, and then I get this offer to direct this movie and direct and produce this movie.
Hmm. Yeah, let's talk about the movie.
Yeah.
What is this movie? Does it have a title?
Yes, it's right. Turn It Around, The Story of East Bay Punk. Nice. And it is executive produced by the fellows in Green Day, who are old hometown friends of ours. And I was just sitting around one day
You know, like we do, we just sit around waiting for things to happen.
Right. Waiting for Green Day to call.
Right. And
call me
every day of my life.
I got this message, and it was like, hey, we're looking for something, and can you help us with this? And I'm like,
no, yeah. We can't help you find drugs, dudes.
Yeah. No, Green Day, stop calling us. We're busy.
Eventually, there was this idea of this film because I had kind of worked around in the archive community and help find some footage that they were looking for. And then there was this idea that I would direct this film. And then the film, it was initially supposed to be about kind of Green Day's early years. And then it grew because Green Day was so connected to the local community and so enamored with the people that they met, the bands they played with back then, that it grew to being about the Gilman bands. And then it was, which I'm told that the authors of Give Me Something Better, the kind of the history of punk book that was put out a few years back. Basically, they were like, we wanted to do a book about Gilman. And then we realized that you got to tell the whole story of the Bay Area. And so this thing has grown to be pretty much about the birth of punk to 1994 when Green Day got really big. And then the epilogue of what's kind of going on today. And it has been is it is the I think Mike told me, he's like, I saw you guys do that. How many artists were in the songbook?
Something like 45.
He says, I saw you navigate, like we did a 192 page songbook with 40 artists with on a publishing deadline. And he says, we watched your videos, all the videos you guys made over the last few years. And I think that you can handle a big project like this. And he wasn't kidding. It's a big project. You know,
it's coming up on what, 2 years now?
It's it started in October of 2013. So it's coming up on 2 years. Yeah. You know, and I mean, it's like Ken Burns style. You know, it goes through, the Mabuhay Gardens and the Dead Kennedys and the Avengers and Flipper, basically the birth of punk in the Bay Area happened in San Francisco. And there wasn't really much going on punk wise in the East Bay. And then the emergence of the Gilman Street Project all the bands that came out of that. And I
think one of the reasons that this film came about rather than, you know, a movie about Green Day solely was that the guys from Green Day are actually they still feel very connected to the community that they came out of. And a lot of bands that were, you know, their contemporaries, their friends, that, you know, that community really did, like, that everyone sort of lifted each other up. And, you know, Green Day sort of graduated, I guess, and became, now they sort of belong to the world. But there's a lot of bands that had plenty to say that, you know, maybe didn't get as many accolades. But it's amazing, like, how deep things go. Like, if this hadn't happened, if this guy hadn't gone to this party, then this band wouldn't have started. Like, there's all these little happenstance, little, you know, butterfly effect kind of incidents that if, you know, for what's the poem, for want of a nail, the shoe was lost, and for want of the horse, the battle was lost. There's little things that have big consequences. That's been the most fascinating thing about working on this film.
It should be premiering by the end of the year, is our hope.
And Dan and Corbett, how are each of you involved in the film? Are you both doing interviews? Or are you?
I'm conducting interviews and directing. Dan is wearing many hats. He's done some assistant directing. He's done story editing. He's our lead story editor. I'm a director and a producer, also an archivist. The Green Day guys are the executive producers. We have our cinematographer and editor is Greg Schneider. Our online editor is Kiva Carty. Our sound guy is Matthew Volker. We're
all wearing a bunch of hats. Like, it's this is, you know, as far as movies go, this is a skeleton crew. Like,
it's,
we're all,
it's punk rock. It's DIY, right?
It's about as close to a DIY film as you get. Like,
the guys from Green Day have been very, very generous about giving us the time to really do our best to dig up this history. And we've gathered over 100,000 archive items, done over 200 interviews. When you think about 2 years, that's not very much time.
That's a hell of a lot of interviews.
So piecing it together, we're going to have to weave it really tight. We have.
Here's what I'm curious though. Like, you know, the punk scene was like so prevalent in the Bay Area for so long. And now I don't know if I'm just getting old or if it's just like changing or becoming smaller, but I feel like I don't hear about it as much anymore personally. Maybe, and that could be because I'm just like agoraphobic.
Thing,
yeah.
It's a 90s thing, man. I mean, you know, I think it's 25 years on. So that's why people want to see this movie right now is because there's a bit of nostalgia involved. We're not trying to glorify nostalgia though. Gilman is still alive and there's still young kids there that need it and that make music and that are in punk bands. They're all growing and learning, and will that same kind of matters of kismet and happenstance, will those things happen again and make that big of a crash? I don't know.
And will it be called punk 10 years from now, 15 years? Who knows? Who cares?
Spork.
It's like, Blagoogie. Really, it's like,
you've been listening to the new Blagoogie music? This freaking makes me so angry. That's punk stuff.
That's Blagoogie as fuck, yo. Dude,
yeah, yeah.
I'm so Blagoogie, I don't give a fuck.
It's been a ride, man. I mean, it's been very surreal. I mean, we are interviewing a lot of people that I never thought I'd even talk to. You know,
it's what's been your favorite interview so far?
Metal Mike from the Angry Samoans.
Oh yeah,
that dude is a wild ass. I don't know if it's he's a savant of some sort. He can he used to be a Rolling Stone critic, but he has this retention of information.
He coined the phrase heavy metal.
Apparently. Yeah, he was.
That's what he's credited with being the first person to use the term heavy metal in Rolling Stone.
I'm trying to think about like who was I the most nervous to interview. Do you have any recollection?
I didn't do any of the interviews.
No, do you ever remember? You go, I don't know. I'm nervous.
Madonna.
We didn't interview Madonna. She's not punk. We could have interviewed.
If you interviewed Madonna, what would you ask her?
We would say, did you send that nude Polaroid to Rancid trying to sign them in 1994? Mm. See, that's the thing.
A little tie-in.
Everybody's fucking connected. I mean, we could really interview anybody for this film, and they might have something to say about, you know.
And, you know,
the world stage.
Another really interesting aspect of this is learning, you know, we both grew up in Pinole or didn't grow up. But what's a big part of the film is the importance of place, you know, and the importance of how a place's cultural history kind of informs how people interact in those spaces. And so there's this whole little micro scene in West County, in Pinole, El Sobrante, that
where we're from.
Yeah, and learning about that, just, you know, looking at the interviews and trying to organize everything, it's the birthplace of death metal, you know.
Possessed.
Yeah, Possessed, a band from Pinole, who, you know, who played in Possessed. Larry Lalonde from Primus.
He also played in a punk band called Corrupted Morals on Lookout Records with Billy Joe.
Yeah.
So I mean, it's
like 6 Degrees of Kevin Bacon.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And
6 Degrees of Larry Lalonde, yeah.
Right, and like, you know, Kirk Hammett. He was from El Sobrante.
He was in everything. You
know, all I used to know was that, like, oh yeah, Green Day went to our high school and we have John Fogerty's old couch.
Yeah, we did.
My friend's mom dated John Fogerty in high school.
Damn. So you, El Cerrito kind of, or?
Well, no, I mean, I'm from like the East Bay, but.
We both grew up in Walnut Creek.
Yeah. Yeah.
So. WC. Walnut Creek.
Machine Head was like the only band in my neighborhood.
They record here. Yeah. I mean, Walnut Creek makes an appearance in the film. The Skin Flutes and. A lot of people say that they talk about Rasputin used to have a limo service where if you were in, what's that, is it Cordelia out there? No, or it's, there's like a lot of little offshoots, little hot places out there. But kids out there felt as trapped as kids in West Contra County.
God.
It was like you had Rasputins, maybe.
Yeah, if we could get there, we'd have to take a bus. It would take like a couple hours. Like, yeah, it was horrible. Growing up in Walnut Creek, I can't express that enough to our listeners. Just how horrible.
Poor business parks.
Oh, come on. You don't miss the Nut House?
The Nut House. Oh, man.
Did you guys ever play the Nut House?
No.
The Nut House was like the place that the city set up for the youth to be at Civic Park after dark inside the buildings that were normally used for like
that's a great
stamp
name
collections and their bonsai tree clubs and stuff. At night they would let the kids in there with adult supervision and so they'd sometimes have bands.
But that is where we would all meet to go do drugs somewhere else in the park. That's what we were doing.
Yeah, after we bought our cigarettes at Flaky's Donuts.
Yeah. Oh man. Yeah. From like an 8-year-old kid, I would. Those were the good old days.
I still live in my hometown, man, and I complain about it. People are like, it's nice in Pinole, and da da da. But when I drive down lately, there's been this woman on at the end of my block, who stands in front of the bar there with headphones with a big sign that says, "Honk if you love Jesus." And I get so mad.
Swerve if you don't.
How do you unhonk?
I go into the post office and I go into a Berkeley post office, just like go buy stamps. I go into a Pinole post office and I see flags all over the place and all of these signs encouraging me to send packages to soldiers that I don't know. And I get mad. And I remember growing up and being kind of, you know, assaulted by football players and jerks and this. And so I decided for some reason I moved back and bought a house there because my wife, her parents live there. And, you know, but now I've been there for a good 6 years again. And I'm like, I gotta get out of here. Like, it's my, the teenage me, it's like, okay, anywhere is what you make it. And at the same time, it's like, no, this is blighted. It kills my brain living in these kinds of places.
I can definitely relate to that. And that is why I love living in Oakland so much. Yeah.
Like, it doesn't kill your brain, but there's a threat of everything else being killed.
Yeah. But I feel like any large metropolitan area I move to, that threat would still be looming.
Sure.
Yeah. And at least this way, like, I'm happy being where I am.
I mean, I was in Oakland, yeah. And there was people with machine guns on my street, and I would hear the person get shot. My wife would wake up hearing the person scream and stuff. And,
now, see, you know, oddly enough, I kind of grew up with that already. Like, I lived... Well, I also, like, I, you know... When I was a teenager, I lived with my grandparents in Walnut Creek. But when I was growing up, I was raised by a single mom. And so we moved around a lot, lived with other single moms. And there were a lot of precarious situations in places where we lived. Like, if you lived off Monument Boulevard in the early 80s, that was not a good place to be. And, like, there would be, like, gunshots going off. Like, I remember once coming home from school, and there's a guy, like, being chased by the cops through the parking lot, and the cops are shooting at him while, like, we're on the sidelines, and, like, you know, then he hops over a fence, and, like, the chase keeps going. And that was just, like, what I grew up around. Yeah. So, like, I don't know. Like, I haven't really experienced that too much in Oakland, like, personally. Like, I've you know, had a gun pointed to me.
Yeah.
You know, or whatever, but like, yeah. I mean, it's not a good feeling, and I didn't leave my house for a few days afterwards.
Yeah.
But like, you know, like I'm still here, you know, and I mean,
it's like the weather, you know, you can only control it so much,
yeah.
Like, and you can't live in a prison. You got to engage with the neighbors, and like,
exactly.
My goal is to be at least on speaking terms with everyone within shouting distance of my house.
That's a good policy.
Because it, you know, a lot of the systems that we sort of depend on, like, you know, go to work and come back and we don't really have to talk to anyone that's like pretty geographically close to us. Like all that, you know, the power goes out for a day and you better get to know the people you live near, mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
It's true.
Stock up on Pop-Tarts.
So
when's this movie coming out? When can we experience it?
I would say that just because it's such a huge thing, we're not really giving it a date. But my guess is there would be a local premiere toward the end of this year, 2015.
You think this year is going to be the bulk of it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're it's hard.
We should be pretty much done with... at least our part, like the actual making of the movie, by midsummer.
I mean, we're combing through over 400 hours of interview footage. You know, it's like, it's absurd.
Yeah.
You know, it's
film's one of those things though, that it's like, it's really hard to put a hard deadline on it. Cause A, you never know what's going to happen. And B, we've never done this before.
Tell a rainbow when to appear?
Exactly.
Come on.
Exactly. If I had a big enough sprinkler, yeah.
Yeah.
I used to know a guy that went on a barge with a big fire hose and made rainbows for people.
That's awesome. Wow. There's going to be a big celebration when the premiere happens and a festival coinciding with it with local bands from the era playing.
No, don't even worry. We'll play. It's fine. Don't even.
Very good. Yeah. Very good. Yeah.
We're happy to officially announce that now on the podcast. Nice.
And there's one other festival you guys are putting on.
Oh,
this
right.
Year?
Okay. So yeah, I'm co-producing a festival called Broken Strings Music Festival, and it's going to be September 25th through 27th.
Not for hippies, really.
Not for hippies. It's a kind of a acoustic punk kind of thing. and it's at an old Boy Scout campground, right on the river, like within, like under a mile from downtown Sacramento.
So, almost sounds a little bit like a horror movie, and except for the 1 mile away from like Sacramento thing, like a bunch
right. But
of
that's
punks
I mean that's
on
a
an
long
ancient Boy Scout burial ground.
That's a long chase scene.
There were a lot of boys that lost their innocence there. There could be a lot of repressed memories.
There definitely will be some repressed memories after the festival.
That's what we're hoping for. And maybe some people will contract venereal diseases, which brings us to one of the best parts of the podcast.
My favorite part, other than the interviews.
Yeah, other than the interview. The only other part of the podcast, the top five list.
Well, we tried to have a science thing, but sometimes we record these at weird times.
There's a donut in space.
Yeah, there's a donut in space. That's pretty rad.
In the vacuum of space, somebody put a donut in space. That's it.
Aliens are going to find that and eat it, and they're going to be like, this is fucking delicious.
You see this report about aliens being like huge?
Well, there's speculation, right?
Yeah, that mm-hmm. potentially, because we have whales here or something, the scientists are basically saying, if we encounter aliens, they're going to be huge. They're going to be like the girth of a polar bear and the size of the tallest man.
It's going to be like Robotech.
Okay. I mean, it all depends on like the gravity and their environment, right? Like, didn't they show in the original Cosmos there were those possible beings that could live on a gas planet that would be like huge inflatable balloons with eyes and they'd inflate and deflate their gas bladders?
That's my girl right there. You know, yeah. Like
they might be a mile wide if the gravity supports it.
Just more of them to love.
Hell
yeah.
No. You know? It's just a venereal disease.
Yeah. Love it. Love it. So, yeah.
So love me a gas giant girl.
All right. Well, there's your science corner for the day, kids. Now it's time for the top five.
Yay!
All right. So this is something that we do with every guest. You guys are the second guest, so this establishes the pattern. Or third guest, I guess, technically.
Because we're in a time warp.
We totally record these in order. I will just let people know that.
Just like films.
All right. So this week's top five theme is songs about diseases, appropriately enough. So the tiebreaker this week, like if anybody has a matching song on their list, then you make the sound when somebody says that. And then you guys are going to use these awesome rock, paper, scissors dice that I brought to be the tiebreaker. So if you lose your song, you have to find another song to replace it.
Okay.
Pressure. So no pressure.
Okay.
Yeah. All right.
But you do it in order. So if your number one song is your number four song, the person who loses would replace either their number one or number four appropriately. Really easy rules. You'll never forget. Okay. Guaranteed.
Okay. I hate games.
Cool.
If you get a green card, you're allowed to stay in this country.
I do not.
I just realized that I have a song on here that you might have.
Maybe.
Get ready to battle.
All right.
Don't worry, guys. If none of my songs get picked, I have a few alts I can go your way.
Okay. So do we play against each other? Is that what happens?
It's, we're all four of us. We all take turns. So you start with your number five. Corbett, you want to start us off with your number five?
My number five is Frank Zappa's Why Does It Hurt When I Pee?
Oh.
Right away. Good song, though.
All right. We got to throw down and see who gets to beat Frank Zappa.
Bitch.
I got scissors.
I got fist.
Ooh, I have to replace my number five. So you get to keep it. Congratulations. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Why does it hurt when I pee?
Like my balls feel like a pair of maracas.
I've got the conkers. All right.
Man, I try and get a Frank Zappa song on each one of my lists if I can.
I have Tom Lehrer. I got it from Agnes.
Oh, that's great.
All right, we got to roll off, Dan.
Scissors
versus scissors.
Scissor me timbers.
We're scissoring each other, Dan.
Oh yeah.
I got a fist. Oh, you cover my fist.
I cover your fist.
You keep it.
I keep it. The force is strong with Bobby Joe Ebola.
Two for two.
Yeah, there you go. I guess it's my turn now, right? So mine is AC/DC, The Jack.
Ah, dirty little song.
Yeah, best song about chlamydia ever. Like, you name another song about chlamydia that's better than AC/DC's. I don't think you can.
I love AC/DC.
Do you guys have a song about chlamydia? It wouldn't be as good as AC/DC. No.
It's probably true. Yeah.
All right, my number five is pretty tame by chlamydia standards. It's Cancer by Joe Jackson.
Oh, there you go.
Nice.
Because, you know, it's a fun song.
Joe Jackson's awesome.
Cancer's always hilarious. a real crowd pleaser. Fun at parties.
Should we keep going in a circle?
Yeah. Number four.
NOFX is Gonosyphil Herpalades.
Ooh. Ooh, nice pick.
I don't have that one.
Yet.
Yeah.
the night is young. Okay. I'm going to go with You Stink But I Love You by Billy and the Boingers.
Huh. Wait, is that a song about disease?
Yeah.
That
is, yeah. So why does he smell because of disease?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. When I got you in the back seat and I tried to make my move, I had to roll down all the windows to keep my face from turning blue.
That's okay. Yeah. Usually if a girl's vagina smells like tuna, it means
there's a sign disease of infection. Going on.
Yeah.
Okay.
And okay. You know, but that goes for boys too. If your junk smells funky, go to a doctor, kids.
That's true.
And if you take one thing away from this week's podcast, I want that to be it. All right.
Clean your balls.
I guess it's up to me now. So I don't think anybody's going to have this, but I put Huey Piano Smith, The Rockin' Pneumonia, and The Boogie Woogie Flu.
That's a great song.
Yeah. I really like this song a lot. It was one of the first ones I thought about. Do you know this song?
No, I don't.
You should learn it because you play the piano. So get to it.
Okay. I think I'm the only one in the room who doesn't know that song. All right. Where are we on? Number four for me. I picked Shake the Disease, which is originally a Depeche Mode song, but I would actually argue that the cover from the For the Masses album by Hoover Phonic is actually a more interesting song sonically.
I'll have to check it out.
But it's a good song in general. I like the Hoover Phonic version, so I'm going to put that in my top four over the Depeche Mode original.
Okay, so I have a quick question. So if I have the Depeche Mode as one of my alts and I need to switch something out, can I still switch it out? Judges, can we get a ruling on that? The judges are saying it's okay.
Wait, what you want permission to keep it in?
Because it's the same song, but it's a different artist.
I think it's the same song, so that's what counts.
Fuck!
Find another alternate, buddy.
I'm so screwed. I already had to use one of them.
My number three song is, and this is a kind of reaching, but Run DMC's "You Be Illin."
That's sick. That yeah.
Thanks. I listened to it today, and I was like, "What about you, Beyond?" And I listened to it. There's nothing about disease in the whole song, but just the title. So.
Well, you know, it's colloquial illness.
Sure. Yeah.
Kind of a disease. Colloquialism is a mimetic disease.
Very true.
There we go. All right.
There we go.
Reaching the disease of the mind.
We did it.
All right.
My next one is I'm All Alone by They Might Be Giants.
Mm-hmm. They speak of a virus in that.
Yeah, it's about a disease from the moon that kills everyone.
Very good.
Grew from the donut.
I'm waiting for one. I know one of you has it.
Space donut?
No, I'm waiting for one particular song about disease from everybody here, and I personally didn't grab it, and I wonder if anybody did.
You mean the obvious one?
That really obvious song about disease. We'll see who has it. But my number three is pretty awesome, I think. It's Weird Al, Mr. Frump and the Iron Lung.
Oh, that's a good call. Yeah. Very good call.
It is. I think it's appropriate not only for the list, but just for this podcast, because I feel like that song has a sort of like morbid humor to it that we all appreciate.
It's a great song.
You can never go wrong with a TMBG or a Weird Al in a top five list because they've got songs about everything.
Mm-hmm.
This is actually a weird one for me. There's no They Might Be Giants songs in this list, which I think might be, this is the only episode of this podcast that'll ever happen on. Mm-hmm. So my number three was I Got It From Agnes. I'm going to replace it with Existential Blues by T-Bone Stankus.
Nice.
Nice.
Very good. Right. I'll take it.
I don't know that song.
You should check it out. It's about not finding satisfaction in life.
All right. I can relate. Okay.
This one came to me almost immediately. And I looked it up, and either by Sarah Vaughan or Peggy Lee, the song Fever. I think even Jessica Rabbit might have covered it.
Yeah. I thought about putting that on my list, but I thought it was too obvious.
Yeah. I was like, I got to do it. I like that song. So,
but you were the rogue, that rogue nation.
I was. I'm just waiting for this one, though, in particular, that's so obvious to a bunch of kind of esoteric, strange musicians here. So I'm waiting.
It's funny that you should mention Fever, because the song I have next is Cat Scratch Fever by Ted Nugent.
Man, the news, that's my number one. Let's roll.
I'm learning something new about Professor Robot here.
I'm rolling for the Nuge. Come on, I got a fist. Scissors. Yes, I am the king of Nuge.
That was the first show I ever went to. My dad took me to see Zakk Wylde, Ted Nugent, and Lynyrd Skynyrd in Rhode Island.
And Nugent fired a crossbow into a guitar and said, "That's what you get for Jap guitars or something."
Yeah, he set up a Yamaha guitar on one end of the stage and got a cross a compound bow, lit an arrow on fire, and told the audience, "This is what we do to Jap guitars." And then shot the guitar from across the stage.
That's a winner.
Fuck yeah, bro.
Yeah.
America.
Some friend of ours.
I'm going to write some songs at the bomb shelter.
Better story. Quanah and Cinque, our friends from the South, lived next door to him for a long time. And one day, just real quick story, I'll try to make this quick. St. Bernard, which was Cinque and Quanah's dog, they were out in the snow playing with the Nugent children. And the St. Bernard jumped on one of Ted Nugent's children, our friend Cinque and Quanah's dog, jumped on one of the Nugent's children and started dry humping it through the kid's snowsuit. And you could just see every hawk and every animal ever in the world, their visages floating in the sky, laughing and, you know, hoping for penetration through the snowsuit for how many animals have been fucked over by
Nuge.
Come on,
dog. Finish before the Nuge gets here.
Yeah.
He's going to pull out his compound bow and do what he does to Jap guitars to you. Look out. Get out of there.
Yes.
So Dan, we were on your number three, weren't we?
Right. Yeah.
Do you have a replacement right away?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
And that would be Frank Zappa, San Francisco.
Go to San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's
about getting the crabs.
I think most Frank Zappa songs are about getting a venereal disease of some sort.
Pretty much.
That's really. True. Yeah.
Or fucking appliances.
Yeah. Sex or sex-related illnesses.
Jump right up and grab my meat.
All right. So what is this? My number two? Is this my number two?
I think, would you like
my number two?
Yeah.
All right. Mudhoney, Touch Me, I'm Sick.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, because I'm punk as fuck. And I don't give a damn.
It's a great band.
Yeah, that's probably my favorite song by them. That song always just it's something about it, because it's really fucking sloppy. But even though the drum beat's like you can just hear the guy trying to keep up. It just hits the right way.
That band, it's
the right amount of swing.
Underrated for sure.
There we go. Let's see who top that.
I think this might be a collision.
Uh-oh.
Ween, AIDS.
See, that's the fucking one I was saying, but I didn't take it.
Yeah.
Because I knew that one, AIDS, or of course there's another one.
HIV.
Yeah. Oh, wait, no.
I mean, you could mention it, but...
I'm not going to mention it. I don't have it. Nobody has it.
Yet.
So...
I think it's time for your number one now.
My number one?
Yeah.
And big one.
This is because I was really got turned on a punk in the 90s. Bad Religion's Infected. It's a very catchy song from 21st Century Boy, the Digital Boy. You know, I love that song.
No, that's a good freaking song.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's on my alternate list if you had AIDS.
Ah, very good. Well, you know, I have something to say on this podcast.
All right. I'm going to go with Nirvana, Mexican Seafood.
Oh. That's pretty good.
So, I mean, everybody already knows my number one was the Nuge.
Yeah.
Cat Scratch Fever. But you want to know my alternate?
Yeah, yeah.
Since all my other alternates, Disturbed, Down with the Sickness. And I'm really surprised that nobody picked that.
That's great. That's
I thought of it. I just had so many songs that I actually wanted to say.
That song is so adorable. He makes Tasmanian devil noises in the beginning.
Wow.
That whole era of just the Tasmanian devil fronting all those bands was incredible.
Pretty great.
Like Taz had like 10 albums that year.
Yeah.
Like 2001.
He was off the hook that year.
Yeah, he had a really really good post Mel Blanc career in funk metal.
And Foreshadowed, I think, by Corbett is my number one. Spinal Meningitis Got Me Down. Smile on. And honorable mention to Take a Piece of Me.
But
Leprosy.
I lost my job selling hot dogs because all of my digits were dangling. I lost my girl. She was my world. She left me when she jerked it off.
That's real.
True poetry, gentlemen.
we were trying to make art for the ages.
And truly you have. Bobby, Joey Bola, and the Children McNuggets. We can't thank you guys enough.
Professor Doctor, thank you so much.
We learned a lot.
So where can people get all of your stuff? Where can they keep up with you?
BobbyJoeyBola.com. They can also find us on the old Face Crap. That's a site for
you. Google Bobby Joey Bola, and just see where it takes you.
Yeah,
it'll probably take you to YouTube. And if you haven't seen our videos, that will keep you from being productive for quite some time.
You can also go to eastbaypunk.com to check out the movie that we're working on.
There you go. All right, and you can find Cartoon Violence at cartoonviolencemusic.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Prof Robot,
and me at Doc Octave.
And you can also follow Cartoon Violence at Cartoon Violins on the Twitter, because we were desperate for a Twitter handle and it was the closest thing we could get to Cartoon Violence.
Are you on Twitter?
Mm-hmm.
What are you on Twitter, Doc?
I am Professor Plague.
Oh, so we could be professor pals.
We could. We could have a little Twitter university.
Corbett Redford on Twitter, I guess. That's not very funny, but good.
It sounds like a superhero, like public persona name.
Thanks.
Like Corbett Redford by day.
By day, I'm Corbett Redford.
Doctor Offensive by night.
Very good.
All right. And with that, guys, we will be back next month with another special guest. So like us on iTunes. Give us all the stars. We need those stars. Just give them to us and write reviews and hashtag stuff.
If we get all the stars, we get to play the bonus level.
That's right. And teacher will like us more. All right. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for having a podcast with us.
Yeah. That was fun, you guys. Thank you.
That was a blast.
Hell yeah.